This is The Guardian.
Enjoying this podcast? Then we think you might love the audio long read, the podcast of The Guardian Long Read, with episodes about caffeine addiction, the secret life of saints, and Britain's strangest pub chain. The Long Read offers great stories and big ideas. Follow the audio long read wherever you get your podcasts.
Every day brings more proof of how Donald Trump wants to upend the Western alliance. But Keir Starmer says that the UK's relationship with the USA is basically unchanged.
Look, we work very closely with the United States on defence, on security and on intelligence. We have done for many, many years. We're intertwined and, of course, they're a reliable ally. We are.
Meanwhile, Trump revels in the success of his efforts to bully Ukraine into agreeing to end the conflict with Russia with virtually nothing in return.
Earlier today, I received an important letter from President Zelensky of Ukraine. The letter reads, Ukraine is ready to come to the negotiating table as soon as possible.
Just to make things even more unsettling, as America has savaged its foreign aid spending, Britain seems to have followed its lead.
Slashing aid further to fund defence spending is not just short-sighted, it is dangerously counterproductive.
There are two big questions here. How much longer can the UK cling on to its relationship with such a changed America? And at what point might Keir Starmer decide to at least begin to break with Trump? I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Weekly UK for The Guardian. When the prospect of a second Trump presidency began to seem more and more likely last year, fears started rising in Europe over what he was saying about Russia, Ukraine and NATO. But even with all the warnings, there often seemed to be a sense that he would never go as far as abandoning the very idea of the Western alliance. So it's still hard not to be shocked, frightened even, by his threats to effectively upend the world order that's been the foundation of Western thinking since the end of the Second World War. This is huge stuff. Patrick Winter is here. He's The Guardian's diplomatic editor. Hi, Patrick.
Hi.
You have written a brilliant, if I may say so, a very eloquent piece in The Guardian this week, which begins by quoting T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. Humankind cannot bear very much reality. You go on to say, at moments in history like these, when there is simply too much head-spinning change and too many post-war assumptions being ripped from their moorings, it sometimes appears too much for any human to absorb, let alone offer a response. You have to respond, it's your job, but that's how you feel, is it?
Yes, I do. I mean, I feel, in common with everyone else, the pace of events and the complexity and depth is overwhelming.
And the gravity of what Trump is saying, crucially.
Yes, once one gets to the full implications of what he is arguing and the relationships he regards as important, which are not those with his allies, but more closely with Russia, and we'll see where he ends up with China, these are head-spinning moments. And I think it's very, very difficult for diplomats in Europe to absorb what's happened and to come up with a kind of coherent response. And not surprising, they're heading off in various different directions, but slowly they're trying to cohere. And I think we're trying to see in Keir Starmer an attempt to be calm in the midst of this storm. But a lot of the British post-war assumptions about its relationship with America are under huge pressure.
That was my next question about Starmer and the government. I mean, you say that it appears too much for any human to absorb. The impression, inescapably, is that America wants out of the Western alliance and it wants a set of allies that would have been unthinkable only 10 years ago, probably less than that, 5 years ago. What's going through the government's mind?
The government is trying to gauge whether there is any means of clawing this back and bringing Trump back on board with Zelensky.
So that's still a possibility as far as the government's concerned,
yes.
Sincerely.
Yes,
on their
I
part.
Genuinely think that is what their focus is, and the aim is to try to put Humpty Dumpty back together again after the disastrous meeting between Zelensky and Trump last week in the Oval Office. And so I think there's been a lot of phone calls backwards and forwards, both with Zelensky and with Trump. and there's a lot of amour propre involved, and understandably, because there's so much at stake and there's people's reputations have been shredded and there's anger on both sides. But what they're trying to do is to convince Donald Trump that Zelensky is interested in peace. He doesn't want a forever war. And they're also trying to put together again this minerals agreement, and it might have to be a minerals agreement that's even more favourable to America than it was before.
And they're still trying to hold the Americans to the idea of a security guarantee that involves active
and
American
the quid pro
participation.
Quo, why this all matters is because both Macron and Starmer insist, and this is the sort of kernel of their position, is that they cannot send in a reassurance force, or whatever name you wish to give it, a European force, plus maybe Canadians and even Turks or some Australians, into Ukraine to protect a ceasefire unless there is some kind of backstop from America in terms of both air cover and intelligence.
But all the signs are, to say the least, that Trump won't wear that.
Well, all the signs always head in one direction with Donald Trump one day, and then they all point in another direction the next day. For instance, I mean, there's been talk that the trade tariffs which were imposed with a flourish might be either rescinded or lowered. So there's still a possibility that you can get them back together again. And Zelensky's gone quite a way and almost said he hasn't quite apologised. He said he regretted the way the meeting turned out last week.
So hope lies in how mercurial and chaotic Trump often appears to be. That's the one source of hope.
Well, I think we in the UK think the ceasefire has to have some kind of military element to it, because so many previous ceasefires and deals that are struck with Russia fall apart.
Yes, they do.
And even if there is this extraordinary supposed personal chemistry between Trump and Putin and whatever source that derives from, that's not forever. Yeah, unless the American Constitution gets changed and Donald Trump becomes president for a third term, there will be a point in 4 years where whatever agreement is reached about Ukraine, the US president will be different to Donald Trump, and therefore those guarantees of that relationship between Putin and Trump will no longer be there.
It might be J.D. Vance, we'll see. Or it might be Trump again, as you alluded to only seconds ago. Let's go back to what decisively pushed many people, onlookers, observers, the likes of me, into fear and despair. The decision by Trump to freeze military aid to Ukraine. Now, the sort of outward choreography of that announcement was that in some way it was caused by what happened in the Oval Office last Friday, the so-called punishment beating given to President Zelensky. Do you think anything policy-wise was materially altered by what happened in the Oval Office on Friday? Or do you think the pause, the withdrawal, whichever way you want to characterise it, of that American aid was probably always going to happen?
I think it was always imminent, in the sense that Trump is really pushing Zelensky very hard, very fast, into coming to an agreement. And Zelensky's incredibly nervous at the pace of events, partly because so many concessions are being made in advance of these negotiations by Trump to Putin. And the faster it goes, the less likelihood there is that the Ukrainians will actually have a say in what's decided, and that instead they're presented with a fait accompli.
Right.
So I think it was set. And
incident.
I think the pyrotechnics of that meeting didn't help and probably maybe brought it forward. But again, it may have been something that was decided very late, because as we understand it, well, I certainly heard and saw Keir Starmer giving assurances to MPs.
That's the next question. On Monday this week, Starmer was asked a question in the House of Commons by Stephen Flynn of the SNP about reports that the US was going to withdraw military aid. And Starmer said very clearly that is not their position.
I haven't seen reports of the US withdrawing support for Ukraine, and as I understand, that is not their position.
So at that point, he didn't know.
He didn't know. And what's more is he did then subsequently have a phone call with Trump, and Downing Street is not willing to say whether Trump divulged his plans at that point. And obviously that would be an extraordinary betrayal or loss of trust if something that was so imminent and so momentous had been decided and he didn't convey
that. Well, it suggests that handing him envelopes with an invitation from the king and being as obsequious as he was albeit calculatedly, only days before, didn't get him very far.
It didn't get him as very far, I don't think. I mean, there was a lot of talk about, you know, maybe we'd get some kind of free trade deal, but it was just words, really. I don't think there was much substance to it. I think it's true that he regards Britain differently because we're not inside the European Union, so he's slightly better disposed to us and he's well disposed to us because we have a royal family and he likes King's Charles. And, you know, he was pretty complimentary to Keir Starmer on a personal level. But in terms of substance, he has not given the UK what it wanted. And I think there's just really, really big differences on not just about how Ukraine's ceasefire would be implemented, but I think their whole approach to Russia is totally at odds.
Zelensky has now offered an olive branch of sorts to Donald Trump. He said the argument, if you call it that, in the Oval Office was regrettable and it's time to make things right and he'll work under Trump's leadership. That's his choice of words. What does that mean?
It means he'll certainly sign this minerals agreement, and it means he knows that the way in which the negotiations are led are going to be conducted by America, and it means he's going to have to work very hard to keep the Ukrainian interest in those talks. And I think there's one danger, which is not yet fully on the radar, is that the Russians will simply say they cannot talk to Zelensky, and whatever negotiations do occur, they're either bilateral with America or that they have to be with a different Ukrainian, but not Zelensky.
Yeah, that one is beginning to sort of hear that drumbeat increasingly. There's a piece in the Daily Mail making the case for Zelensky.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard British diplomats say, well, maybe you would have to sacrifice him. And he himself has said that he's would stand aside if, say, Ukraine was given membership of NATO. But once he's started to make those kinds of suggestions of standing aside, he could stand aside for other reasons as well.
But morally, that would be an awful thing to see, wouldn't it?
Well, the point of the contest between America and Europe is that the sovereignty of Ukraine is what is at stake, and there cannot be any more sovereign decision than who should be your leader.
Precisely.
And if that's the leader's being imposed upon you by Washington, Ukraine has lost its sovereignty.
In a few words, do you think there's any expectation of US military aid being reinstated?
I think we've made the offers possible. Whether any kind of further offers can be made to America is in question. One idea that I've heard is that these Russian assets could be frozen and seized, and some of that money be guaranteed to America in terms of defence contracts. But
that's complicated. So you get the Americans to reinstate military aid by giving them lots of frozen Russian money from Europe.
Yes, that's the one proposal. I mean, maybe it's a measure of the desperation as people cast around, but they're trying to think of what sweeties and goodies that can be given to Trump, apart from letters from King Charles. What are the substantive things that Europe can do? I mean, obviously, they're trying to show that they're taking it very seriously in terms of increasing their own defence expenditure, becoming more self-reliant. But is there, in this kind of mad world of deals that have to be the basis on which diplomacy is transacted, is there anything financially that Europe can offer to America?
If that military aid wasn't reinstated, which in all likelihood it probably won't be, Europe can't satisfactorily help Ukraine on its own right now, can it? Time is a huge factor here.
Yes. I mean, the EU's got this summit on Thursday at which Ursula von der Leyen is putting forward these proposals about loosening the fiscal straitjacket of national governments so that you could see up to $800 billion extra defence spending coming out of Europe. But that is over 3 to 4 years. And the issue really is, how is Ukraine going to survive the next 3 to 4 months?
Because that American equipment, which has been paused, as I understand it, is physically exists. It's now sitting in storage facilities in the US. So if you compare that to the idea that slowly some imaginary European military machine might crank into life and then begin to produce substitute arms and so on, that's where the two timeframes are completely different.
They are. And I think it's not just weaponry that's in America. There's actually weaponry that's in Poland on the way to Ukraine that's been stopped.
God, it's as direct as that, is it?
Yes. So it is really essential that they try to persuade Trump to rescind this freezing. But it looks like it's going in different directions at the moment, because not only is military aid being frozen, the intelligence that Ukraine receives from America is also being frozen, and they're going to receive no more. So that will be leaving Ukraine without weapons and fighting blind.
Do you get any sense that anyone within the Ministry of Defence, Foreign Office, Downing Street, or all three has in their mind what some decisive breakpoint with America might look like, and the idea that we're going to get there in all likelihood sooner or later? Certainly in terms of it playing any constructive role as far as Ukraine's concerned. That there will come a point at which we have to just say, well, this isn't working.
Well, there may be a point when Russian forces are pouring through Ukraine. There is no American weaponry there to help, and Zelensky is being forced from office.
Okay. But at that point, surely Starmer that can't then stand there saying America remains our greatest ally and we have every faith that they will remain on side and NATO is as strong as ever and all those things that one hears. That will just be absurd, won't it?
Yes, but obviously he's working as hard as possible to avoid that. I know there's a sort of a massive desire on the British left that there's going to be a Love Actually moment. It's not going to happen, but because I think it's such an article of faith inside the British establishment that the American relationship is integral to what we represent, that it takes a huge leap of the imagination to imagine that no longer being the case. And it's going to take a very bloody set of events, maybe over the next 4 months, for that set of assumptions to collapse.
Without wanting to depress the people listening, one thing I might take from our conversation is that bloody, chaotic, awful outcome to all this, as far as Ukraine itself is concerned, on balance, is by far the most likely outcome.
I just think it needs to be part of the way in which people think about the possibilities of the next few months, and that it's sort of this assumption there's either a ceasefire or there is a continued war. What's possible is there's a Ukrainian defeat, and it could be very bloody and horrific.
Huge, mind-boggling times. Thank you for joining us, Patrick.
Pleasure.
Right, we're going to pause here for a moment. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the government's cut to foreign aid.
Enjoying this podcast? Then we think you might love the audio long read, the podcast of The Guardian Long Read, with episodes about caffeine addiction, the secret life of saints, and Britain's strangest pub chain. The Long Read offers great stories and big ideas. Follow the audio long read wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. Last week, to the surprise of a lot of people, including some in government, Keir Starmer announced he would be drastically cutting the UK's foreign aid spending in order, he said, to increase defence spending to 2.5% of GDP. This is the single largest cut to the UK's aid programme ever and will take the overall budget from 0.5% of gross national income down to 0.3% in 2027. So it's quick. Labour pledged in its manifesto that it would actually do the opposite, promising to restore aid spending to 0.7% of GDP. So this decision, as you'd expect, has attracted no end of criticism. The Minister for International Development, the outgoing minister, Annalise Dodds, resigned over the cut. Labour-backed benchers have drafted a letter to Keir Starmer protesting against the decision, and more than 100 charities have written to the Prime Minister asking him to reconsider. Tara Ghazi is the co-chief executive of Action Aid, and she's with me now. Hello, Tara.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. First of all, tell us about ActionAid, what you do, and how much of it was or is dependent or bound up with the government's aid budget.
ActionAid, we work worldwide to look at how we can support people living through injustice, inequality, and particularly our work focuses on working with women and girls.
Okay.
So, for example, at the moment, worldwide, there are around 120 million people who are either refugees or displaced from their homes. Out of those 120 million, over 50% are women and girls. And out of those women and girls, one in five will have experienced gender-based violence. Funding within the aid sector globally, only around 0.1% of that money goes to supporting survivors of gender-based violence.
Okay.
So we at ActionAid, with our focus on working with women and girls, are very, very concerned.
Can you answer that question directly? I don't know whether you can. How much of your work was or is dependent on the government's aid budget? Do you have an idea?
Well, there's quite a lot of confusion at the moment. So, for example, when President Trump announced the aid cuts in the US, we knew immediately what was going to happen. And so, for example, within weeks, we had to close down a program that was funded in Zambia. And that program was working with women who are basically being exploited within very remote fishing villages. So that was devastating. With the UK cuts, the pictures not quite as clear. So, for example, we currently have a multi-million pound programme funded by the FCDO, which is looking at ending female genital mutilation. Given that in Somaliland, the FGM prevalence rate is about 98% of the female population, we were very pleased to hear that this program is not likely to be cut. And we're very pleased because we've managed to get the government of Somaliland to introduce an anti-FGM policy. However, what we're not clear about is in 2027, when these cuts happen, what happens to that type of funding? Because a success like that takes absolutely years.
Yeah. So you're sitting here feeling anxious because the honest answer to that question is you don't know. And in all likelihood, this cut will put some of that work in jeopardy. That's what it feels like.
It's safe to say it will put some of our work in jeopardy. And what really concerns us is that our new strategy at ActionAid is to try to fund more directly smaller women's rights organisations, because we know that those organisations understand best what people need, you know, what people need in their own country, in their own context. And we are really worried that these cuts will be very deep and will affect those smaller organisations the most, because they're less able to access funds. So, for example, if I give one example of that, if you think about Uganda, Uganda's hosts the biggest number of refugees in Africa at the moment. It's about 1.5 million refugees. Now, 60% of those are from South Sudan. That crisis is getting worse. 30% are from DRC. That crisis is getting worse. We're funding small women's rights organisations who are supporting women and girls coming across those borders, education, survivors of sexual violence. So our ability to fund organisations like this will decrease.
Was there any pre-warning, as far as you were concerned, about the fact the government was about to do this?
No, we found out the morning that it was announced.
How did you feel?
I mean, we were in shock. I personally felt very angry. I've worked in the sector for a very long time. And this government made a commitment in its manifesto, as you said, setting out itself as a key player in contributing to international development. And not only that, David Lammy talked about the climate crisis being fundamental to global stability, fighting the climate crisis, and that his Foreign Office would do everything in its power to do that. And we think this is a retrograde step, because if you look at the number of refugees worldwide, some of those are being pushed or displaced by conflict, some by the climate crisis. So effectively, what we're going to see is an increase in military spend, a decrease in humanitarian spend, and therefore less ability for organisations like ourselves to support those fleeing conflict or war.
And just to go back in a more sort of direct way of looking at it, because the danger with these conversations very often, I would imagine within government particularly, is a lot of the work you do gets lost in abstracts, right? But you're talking about people who are living in the most abject, awful circumstances, having had the most dreadful experiences, who urgently need very, very basic help, right, in order to survive, and the plug being pulled on that work.
Yeah, so I was deployed into the Ukraine crisis at the beginning of the war. I was there for about 2 months on the borders between Poland and Ukraine. And what I can tell you this is that there were thousands and thousands and thousands of women and children coming across those borders. And I interviewed many of those women. And with deepest respect to, the military and soldiers who have to go and fight wars, those women did not want to see more soldiers when they came across those borders. They did not want to see more soldiers. They wanted to see organizations, mainly run by women, who could actually support them, who could give them a safe place, who could give them a tent to stay for the night, who could make sure that they weren't going to be trafficked out of that camp where they were staying in. Because obviously along the borders, there will always be traffickers.
But that's a universal
it's
thing.
It's a universal.
Wherever there is human movement and conflict, and women and girls are affected by it, that's what happens.
It's a universal. So I could have been anywhere in the world. Yeah. I happened to be in that particular crisis, and the work that organisations that we were funding were doing was absolutely fundamental to those women's protection and their safety.
Let me ask you about where this sits. I'm going to do exactly what I just accused other people of here and talk about it in slightly abstract political terms. But there is a huge question here about what some people call soft power and British influence and the idea of the UK as a force for good around the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not why you're there. You're not helping women and girls coming across borders to assist British soft power. But if you're trying to make the case to politicians, that's part of the reason that they should be doing it.
Yes, because, we believe that it's a retrograde step for the UK to follow along the lines of other governments putting nationalist interests first.
Well, one government in particular at the moment led by Donald Trump, right?
Yes, so we think that increases global instability and global insecurity.
The public, it seems, if you look at polling, for what polling is worth, I'm a polling sceptic, really. I think people sit them very often like general knowledge tests. It doesn't necessarily indicate deep feeling. But people talk about the fact that cutting foreign aid is popular in polling. And, you know, there are certain elements of the press, the right-wing press, that have been making these noises for a long, long time. Do you think that indicates a political failing, really, that the right politicians haven't made the case for aid, achieving the things that you've talked about? And being as sort of morally important as it is, and therefore the way has been left open for a move like this.
I do think so. And actually, it's very interesting you say that, because if you look at the Charities Aid Foundation, their latest report on giving across the UK, you can see that the UK population is incredibly generous.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're talking about 50% of adults give to charity. 50%. Now, that is not a minority of the population. That is half the population. So to actually say that the British public would support this, I don't see the evidence for that. I feel that, the government effectively uses the aid budget as a piggy bank, to dip in and out of when the next geopolitical development happens. But it isn't a piggy bank to be raided, because we're talking about people's lives.
Yeah, it has to be stable and certain. And you have to have an idea that it endures into the future, which a move like this completely cuts across. Mm-hmm. And if someone says, well, hold on a minute, the stakes couldn't be higher. We're now faced with these huge questions of war and peace and Russia potentially defeating Ukraine and the defence of Europe and so on. So something's got to give. What's the answer to that?
Well, I'm not an economist and I'm not a politician. However, we are... one of the world's richest countries, and we made a commitment. Now, this is a legal commitment, okay, to 0.7. And I know that the bill was amended under the last government to 0.5, but with a promise that they would try to bring that spending back up. So the idea of having a percentage is that when your income of your country goes down, okay, maybe the amount of money you're giving
that's a
down,
point often missed, isn't it?
Whereas, so to me, it actually doesn't make any sense.
Looking to the long term, perhaps the very long term, what do you think this cut will mean?
I think what it means for an organisation like ActionAid is that we will be relying even more heavily on the generosity of our supporters. And we know that our supporters are people like you and me, who have probably our own struggles, our own mortgages to pay.
And times are increasingly hard as far as people and their spending and all that is concerned.
Yes, so we're relying more and more on the generosity of the British public to do the right thing. And why should it be the British public who have to do the right thing, when really what we're asking for is our government to step up and do the right thing?
To look at that question in a different way about the long term, I mean, not very long ago, we saw the Department for International Development axed entirely under Boris Johnson, right? So it's not like that you know, there haven't been rumblings or signs of something like this coming down the track, and here it is. How do you feel about the prospect of the UK continuing to support the kind of vulnerable people that you've talked about around the world now?
Well, given the minister's announcement to resign, Annalise Dodds' announcement to resign, given the fact we have Labour backbenchers furious about this, given the fact that FCDO officials...
Frontbenchers privately furious about it as well.
FCDO officials also very unhappy. I think that this backlash will continue. And what we're asking for is a reversal of the decision. And we will continue with others in the aid sector to put pressure on the government to do so.
Do you think you might get at least a partial reversal?
We hope so. We hope so. The one thing they cannot take away is hope, I guess. And don't forget that this is a legal commitment and that the government at some point needs to look at returning to 0.7.
They've said they will over time. It's just when exactly that arrives, well, and whether that's just talk.
Looking at the economy and the predictions around the economy, we're looking at around 10 years.
It's interesting as well. I suppose in the midst of a moment like this, people with pretty awful views can kind of make the argument that this is some sort of lefty indulgence. But 0.7 was something that David Cameron and George Osborne believed in. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I actually smiling, thinking about them and thinking, I wish we could go back to those days.
No, I'm told that. Somebody I met the other day told me George Osborne is scandalised by this move. And that's Mr. Austerity, which sort of shows you where we are.
Yeah, because I think that people understand that Britain, the UK has a really long history of standing up on the world stage and being a world leader. And in order to do that, you know, it's you have to look at the bigger picture. We have to look at the bigger picture beyond our own borders.
That's why you're here and that's why we've been talking to you. Thank you for joining us, Tara.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of you for listening, and thank you to the people who've been writing to us at our new email address, politicsweeklyuk@theguardian.com. Please keep your thoughts and questions coming about today's episode or anything else you'd like us to discuss. This episode of Politics Weekly UK was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Zoe Hitch and Nicole Jackson.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Friedland from the Politics Weekly America podcast. Donald Trump has started his second term. It's going to be a turbulent period, and The Guardian will be here covering it all. We have no billionaire owners or shareholders pulling at the purse strings. So, if you can afford it, please do support us. Every contribution powers our independent journalism. Do click the link in the episode description.